Here we go. It's time for Tommy's Holiday Camp. Bye-bye and hi to Arnaldo.
Good morning, campers.
Welcome.
Hello and welcome, everybody, to another boisterous edition of Tommy's Holiday Camp. And thank you, Miss Laura. We've just been doing the old knees up in the studio here to the camp song. And thank you very much for a wonderful show. Great to have you back this week. Okay, and Laura is just going on to look for my guest for tonight. Going to be sitting in with me is Howard G. Charing. And he is... let's say a teacher, writer, a lot of things, and I think you'll find some of his experiences quite interesting. So anyway, he's coming right up, and basically in between, got a bunch of music I'll be playing, which I recently just came back from England for a visit and bought a few CDs, a lot of old folk stuff from the 60s and early 70s, and also psychedelic and some early proto heavy metal. So we'll be playing a little mixture of that music that I bought up. And my guest today in the studio is Howard G. Charing. Say hello, Howard.
Oh, hello, everybody. Hi.
Good, good. And Howard's literally just flown in from the outer reaches of the universe, otherwise England, called England.
Outer reaches universe.
Yeah. And so we're going to be talking about some very interesting things, some of his experience he's had as a teacher, a shaman, and a writer, and whatever else you might call it, you know. His experiences within the in South America, in the Philippines, in Britain, Europe. So anyway, I'm going to play a song, one of the songs I first picked up on my trip. It's been out of print for literally almost 40 years. One of my favorite, what would you call it, albums in those days, they were called. And this is Dr. Strangely Strange, and this is his Strangely Strange But Oddly Normal. Oh, yes, Strangely Strange But Oddly Normal by Dr. Strangely Strange. And, yes, you get strange stuff here on cows. In fact, Howard was just telling me there's something called the Cow Parade, and cows are being placed, statues of cows are being placed all around the world, it appears.
Yeah, the Cow Parade, it's an international exhibition. It's been travelling around many, many cities of the world. I was in Lima, Peru, the past 18 months, and had all over Lima these beautiful cows, each done by artists. Each one was individually designed and painted by an artist, some very, very good artists. And there's been everywhere, Tokyo, New York, I think, check it out, the Cow Parade. Yeah, it's been, as your cow's here, so I thought you'd be interested in the Cow Parade.
We need one. We need a cow. Anyway, welcome Howard into the studio. We're going to chat and play music. But now Howard's done some very interesting things in his life. He's been to some very interesting places, and from the deep in the Amazon jungle to the Philippines, to literally all over Europe. So we're going to chat about some of his experiences there. And right now, Howard has just completed a book, a very epic book, one might say, of an artist called Pablo Amoringo.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps tell us how you got involved with Pablo and then decided to write a book about his work.
Well, that's a long story, Arnold. A long story.
We've got loads of time.
Loads of time. Okay, so let me just give you a quick summary of a synopsis of the long story. Well, I've always admired Pablo's work. I came into contact with it in the mid-90s when a book was published called Ayahuasca Visions by Pablo Amoringo and Eduardo Luna. And the paintings were so so visionary, so interesting, and also the narratives explaining the mythology and the stories and the traditions of the Amazonian people and the plant medicines, and particularly with ayahuasca, you know, and the spiritual and visionary effects of that particular plant.
Can you give some background on ayahuasca? What is it, and who uses it, and how did it what happens with it?
Well, I can do that. Yeah, it's ayahuasca is two words put together. Ayah means vine, vine, lana, vine, and wasca is kind of a. It basically means, it's a catch-up, I'm sort of jet-lagged here, it means vine of the dead or vine of the soul.
Hmm.
It's a very ancient brew, and I'm saying it's a brew. It's not conventionally like a plant hallucinogenic or something else. It's a mixture of two plants, and that's what's interesting about this. It's a mixture of the chacruna plant, the leaves of the chacruna, and the ayahuasca vine itself. And how they work is really interesting, because the hallucinogenic compounds are in the leaves, the tryptamines are in the leaves, and in the vine contains an inhibitor which prevents the body from reabsorbing the tryptamine compounds. Now, what's very interesting about this is one that asks these questions. I mean, how do they know to mix these leaves with this particular vine? And it uses what was discovered by Western science in the 1950s as the MAOI effect, the monoamine antioxidant inhibitor, which is the vine inhibits the body from reabsorbing the tryptamines, which would be immediately, if they're taken orally, they're immediately reabsorbed and there's no effect. So you ask yourself the question, how do they know to mix these two particular two plants? And that's a fascinating question, which no one's really understands, no one really can find out. So when you ask the local shamans and so on, how did you know about this? And they can give you legends. Well, the grandfathers were told by the plants, and the plants told they mix this. This vine with this leaves, and this will happen, and that will happen. You will never know why or how they discover this, because they're two separate plants and so on. And in the Amazon, there grow thousands and thousands of different species of plants. So that's a mystery which, rationally you can't explain. But I go along with what they say, is that the plant told us, because, the consciousness was very different. It's changing now, but it was very, very different. And people were. They lived in the rainforest, much more in tune with the plants. I mean, the plants are not seen as things, as just kind of inanimate objects. Mm-hmm. They're seen perceived to have a consciousness, a mind, which we communicate with human beings and so on. And so it's not kind of a herbalist thing. It's not like we mix up these herbs with our medicine and so on. It really is. They embark on a discipline called la dieta, the diet, which means they take the plant over a prolonged period of time, months, maybe a couple of years, and during this very, very strict practice, very demanding practice, there's a lot of prohibitions on what they can eat, what they can do, and so on, and no contact with anybody. My hypothesis is that the idea of the diet is to quiesce, in some respects, the more animal, monkey, primate kind of aspect of ourselves, and to become more plant-like. And so when we're in a situation, we can become more plant-like, if that makes any sense to anybody, then we can communicate with the plants. And, there's other interesting things about this. You heard about the CIA experiments with Ralph Baxter and the lie detector tests.
No.
Well, this lie detector expert for the CIA called Baxter. I'm digressing here because I can do ayahuasca, but it's just to get onto this plant consciousness thing.
Yeah.
That for some, I've got the exact details now, but how he started. But he decided to see if plants reacted to emotional response, emotional situations, to our thoughts and so on. And when he wired the lie detectors to plants, and he had thoughts about, I'm going to burn these leaves, I'm going to pull out these plants, zoop 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 on the meters and things, and on the readout. And so he determined through these experiments, Clive Baxter. I'm still jet lagged, guys, so please be with me. I only arrived yesterday. He determined that there is a kind of a emotional response from plants to our thoughts and so on. And a lot of people, this is anecdotal, a lot of people talk to their plants. They treat their plants as friends. And And they say, when I talk to these plants, and they really flourish, they really grow. These plants I don't really talk to, and they don't do much, and so on. So there is a kind of a whole dimension of human-plant interaction, which we in the West don't really have, don't really understand, and actually have dismissed plants as inanimate. Well, they're not inanimate, obviously.
Right.
They have an intelligence. I mean, some of David Attenborough's work, particularly I'm talking about the BBC production of The Secret Life of Plants. When you start using time-lapse photography and other techniques, then you start seeing plants in different action, different perspective, and so on. So basically, you know, we're talking about humans thousands of years ago had a different consciousness, and the consciousness which they could commune with nature, they could commune with plants, and this is how somehow they understood that mix. You cook these plants for hours. You cook these leaves with this vine for many, many hours, and this brew is brew, and this would give you an entrance into the spirit world. This would give you visionary, divinatory abilities, and so on.
And so on.
So, you know, although traditionally people take ayahuasca, the indigenous peoples take ayahuasca for health purposes, for cleansing. It clears the body of parasites and all sorts of very, very healthy. This is called a purge. It just purges all the rubbish and junk out of you. You know, it has become quite a lot of interest from the Westerners who've seen ayahuasca as something really for the future, a plant which can really help humanity, help us to see on a personal level. It's not going to, hey, this is going to help humanity, because humanity evolves through individuals, you know, and through individuals the collective is transformed. So it's seen as a personal transformational method, And people do this. It's a discipline. It's not something casual. It's not for everybody. It's not something that ayahuasca is good for you kind of thing. But a lot of people can help, and it changes people's lives. There's no question about this.
How does it work? What happens when you take it? You know, what is the process? What do you see? What do you feel? What is the?
I'll give you a synopsis, or give you. It's very subjective, obviously, but for start, it tastes disgusting. It really, really, really. Okay. The more I drink it, the harder it gets.
Really? Easier. Oh.
I really have to steel myself. I have to kind of hold my nose. I don't smell it, you know, and knock it down in one go, you know, because it tastes. If you don't know what it tastes like, you're okay. It's one of those things, you know. You know what it tastes like. You kind of, you know, your stomach's really cringing, you know, making these funny noises and so on. Then it goes down. Then you have a sense of nausea for a little bit because it tastes so disgusting, and not disgusting. Challenging is the word.
Okay,
it's a challenging taste. You know, it challenges you. And then anyway, I kind of get through those early stages to smoke with Pachos, which is locally grown tobacco, and that kind of takes away some of the taste and so on. You know, I would say, you know, the effects vary. You know, it's some people for the first time they may go through more of a purging process. You know,
a physical
vomiting and evacuation from the other side.
Okay,
and. Which is a good thing. It's not. I know we in the West think vomiting is a very bad thing. Poor show. You're sick. You're a bad person, or you've drunk too much, and so on. But really, vomiting is one of the most powerful ways to cleanse yourself. It really cleanses you. Now, of course, you're not just cleansing the contents of your stomach, which is part of it, but you're also cleansing on another level, kind of a pain, wounds, emotional wounds, and pain, and so on. So a lot more is coming out than just the contents of your stomach, and. So the purge is very, very important. You know, I know people resist being sick, but you know, you just go along with it. It cleanses, and after you've been sick, then the visions can happen. Then the visions tend to start to happen. You see things about yourself, the trance affects people different ways. You know, some people kind of go know certain peaks in the trance, certain moments in the trance, and so on. They can go certain directions with this, and so on.
Can you guide it then, or is it really guiding you? How does that work?
This is the thing. You know, I mean, we can think we guide it, but the ayahuasca is actually, you know, the conscience of this particular. I mean, I'm speaking kind of metaphysical here, but the conscience of that plant is greater than our minds, and so on. So it's really best to kind of not to try and guide it, not to try and kind of limit it by our own thoughts. Our thoughts can be limiting because when we think typically in language, words, and the linguistic, though language is very, very important, obviously, and words have a lot of meaning.
Right.
But language in that respect, thinking in words, kind of limits us. You know, but. allow the ayahuasca to show you what you need to do. You know, it's for your benefit in many respects. It may not be comfortable. You may be re-experiencing parts of your lives which were very difficult, very demanding on you, very upsetting and whatever. And then you may find you re-experience something in your life, and then you desire to purge, the huge desire to go and vomit.
Mm.
And that's it. You're cleansing yourself from this, not just the stomach contents, but you're cleansing that emotional wound,
that
part of your life, and so on. So people talk cosmic and so on about ayahuasca, showing them the universe and the cosmos and so on and so forth. But that's a very Western overlay.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you drink with the local people. The shamans don't talk about the cosmos and things. They talk about things in their lives. My life isn't working well. I'm very unlucky. You know, I can't get a job. You know, is my boyfriend cheating on me and so on. All these kind of things. Things which make people's lives, you know.
The everyday things.
Everyday stuff, yeah. You know. Only us Westerners who everyday stuff is okay. They've got the money, they've got food, and they've got a house to live in, they've got a car to drive and so on, who have the existential spiritual questions. So it's very a Western thing. And of course, some of the shamans get included into this kind of thing. Some of them talk about cosmos and things and universe, but that is not how it's drunk traditionally.
Okay.
You know, it's traditionally for everyday life, it's to heal and to cleanse your life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as you heal and cleanse your life, you become a part of the solution, if I'm speaking in that kind of thing. You change, and as you change and transform, other people around you kind of change and transform. So it has a kind of a knock-on effect.
Right.
So ayahuasca is a lot of interest in the West right now. It is a spiritual experience. There's no question about this. It's a physical experience. It's an emotional experience and so on. And it can be very challenging. But it's something, if you're interested in, you can read as much as you want about it. But reading and listening to lectures and listening to people like myself talking about it is really not the point. The point is actually going and drinking it and giving yourself a bit of time around it to work with it and so on. And drink it with someone you trust, someone who's okay. So it's a whole bunch of factors around this.
Yeah.
You know?
And in fact, we were just talking during the music break about that everyone was started hearing the same.
That's right. Yeah, ayahuasca. Back to ayahuasca stories. You know, and what I haven't mentioned is the chants of the ayahuasca, the shaman, and many of them are in tribal language, tribal dialects. So it's very difficult for Westerners to understand. Some are in Quechua, which is understandable. It's the language of the Andes, of the Incas, and so on. And some are sung in Spanish, but And the traditional tribal language chants are regarded as more powerful, have more energy to this and so on. But take that away, it's still the sound, the vibration that the maestro makes. It can be, say, the Shipibo, for example. Shipibo are a tribe living in the upper Amazon. There's about 20,000, 25,000 of them. And they are kind of the masters of ayahuasca, and their chants. And I can play some. I've got on my MP3 player. I've got some chants I recorded at sessions and so on, and their chants range from the highest falsetto note to the deepest bass and so on, and they have a huge effect on the structure and the formation of the trance. I'm using the word trance in a loose sense here, but it's called it's a trance. You know, you're altered state of consciousness and so on. And these chants, the vibration, influence the whole thing. And occasionally, when I chant as well, when I drink ayahuasca for friends and so on, and it's an exquisite experience. You know, the vibrations have a form, have a structure that they can change and so on. They can change things. It's extraordinary. I'm talking about something, but one of those things you can talk about, but you have to do it to understand it, so to speak, you know, if that makes any sense to anybody.
Yeah, so really the music becomes part of them. They're really working with it in that trance.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, certain chants we're calling initially, say, for example, calling the protective powers, we're calling the plants, the minds, the spirits of the plants, the minds of the spirits, animals. I remember seeing years and years ago, I was in the jungle, sitting in the clearing in the jungle, drinking ayahuasca with a shaman, and he started chanting. And suddenly the place is filled with these fireflies everywhere and the moths everywhere and so on. And later on, the following day, I asked him, that was really interesting, you know, a bunch of things I asked him, talked to me about. Your first chant, you know, all these, the fireflies came and all these insects and all the birds started singing and so on, you know. Yes, that's what I did. I was calling in the protective forces of the insects and the fireflies to the ceremony, so bringing in the spirits to protect us and so on. And I've seen that many, many times and so on, those kind of things.
So now when people take it as a group, what's the difference there? When they take it together rather than by themselves.
Well, what's the group? You know, another story here.
See, two people more. So many, plus.
Well, I'm not being facetious here, you know. But it depends on the group. Yeah, if it's a group of, for example, I speak myself personally here because I can do that, you know.
Yeah.
I don't like to drink ayahuasca with a group of people who've never drunk it before.
Mm-hmm.
Because the ceremony, the session will be very disjointed. People won't be really into the groove, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They'll be, you know, retching and making noises and disturbing you and so on. But after the third or fourth session they've drunk together, then I'm very happy to take a full dose with them and so on. I used to run groups for many years, from the 90s on to about 2 years ago. I used to have a centre, my colleague in the Amazon, Mishana. It's a beautiful place. It's in a national reserve. It's really exquisite, lovely place. Mm. And very few mosquitoes, which is it's really nice. Yeah, the water, the Rio Nanai, is called a black river. And it's acidic, slightly acidic. So there's no mosquitoes there. So you can sit around in T-shirts and short sleeves and shorts and whatever.
Heaven.
And not worry about it. It's great. and it's very beautiful, very peaceful and so on. And I forgot what I was talking about now.
Yeah. Oh, the groups taking it as a group.
Yeah, the groups, yeah. So it takes two or three sessions for an individual to kind of get used to the actual medicine, yeah? Mm-hmm. It's very challenging, as I said before. But after two or three drinks, and if they haven't been deterred by the taste or the effects of it or whatever, they're in the groove. They're in the kind of mellow out, so to speak. And then the ceremony will be much smoother, and I'm very happy to drink, mm-hmm. you know, after that. So a group is not a kind of a fixed thing. A group is made up of individuals. I know there's this a group consciousness kind of stuff. It's still different individuals, and
right.
So you can't say a group is the same because a group is different people and different things. You have to gauge the people. Are they comfortable? Are they mindful of other people and so on? These things, you know. So there's many, many factors involved in this. It's not black and white. In any
right.
way.
Right. How long does it take that session once you've drunk it to when you sort of come out of it? Is there a
it depends, you know, on the doses and the strength?
Yeah.
You know, it's so. I would typically say it's best to drink it at night time. So you start, you know, and the Amazon, being kind of near the equator, it gets dark every night at 6:30. So so from about 7:30, 8 o'clock is a good time to drink. And you haven't eaten all day long, so you've had breakfast, a light breakfast, and you no food, nothing, you just drink water and so on, and no stimulants in any way whatsoever. It can go on for about 4 hours on a normal dosage, but sometimes it's very concentrated, very strong, and the different kind of plants you can mix with the things, not just all sorts of variables here. It can go on for many hours, you know, many, many hours. So it depends, but I think 4 or 5 hours is typically the maximum for a session.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is interesting. These are two ayahuasqueros, two shamans chanting together. And normally that could be a disjointed experience because they're both, because these different vibrations can create different effects. But these two sing in such a great harmony. One is El Di Shibibo, Benjamin Ochovano. And this is recorded back in, I think, 2002. And he was 83, 84 at the time.
Mm.
And he had a voice, he could sing after sessions, you know, going for hours. He used to go back to his little cabin and still singing, you know, it's great. And I bumped into him last year. He's moved. This is a Shibibo Indian, he's an old timer, he's in his 87, 88 now. And he's still strong as an ox, that guy. And he's singing with on my MP3 player, it's gone a bit haywire, I can't control it very much. I'll just keep on talking until it comes back here.
Okay.
And he's singing here with a young guy called Rolando. And they sing together so well. And so I recorded these chants back in, you know, 2002. And I'm going to play the first one now for you. I'll play a couple of tracks here.
Okay.
Are you ready?
We're ready.
Ready. Here we go. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness, that was just truly beautiful, Howard.
Yeah, that was just one of the chants. They're called Icaros, by the way, and that's one. We just went halfway through one chant, you know, it's probably advisable. It may sound silly. Probably advisable not to play too much of this because it does shift your conscience, your mind, and so on. So, but that's a nice example of two shamans singing together in beautiful harmony and so on. I've got lots more tracks. Maybe we'll play one or two later on. But that was the high falsetto voice was sung by, you know, an 87-year-old shaman. I mean,
yeah,
and he could go on singing all night. You know, and his voice could vary, you know, in octaves from that kind of falsetto, high-pitched falsetto to a sound which you think is a power driver, you know, really deep, sonorous, thunder-like sound. So it's very interesting, you know, the Shibibo Indians who have a real connection and understanding of the magical world of plants. And, you know, people call it kind of a superstition or some kind of magic and so on. But they can do things. They can create certain circumstances, like they can chant and certain animals come to them, certain insects come to them and so on. I mean, I've seen it myself.
Well,
and
they have those connections still that we don't see anymore.
They still have those. They're also renowned for their artwork, their design. You know, I've given you a couple of those things, you know, very complex geometric patterns. But they're actually kind of chants. They're actually songs in geometric form. They have a whole very different world of sound. And for those who are more interested in exploring this a bit more, I have an article or two on the internet. I think it's on www.scribd.com. I've got some articles about the Shibibo and their sound, the magical world of their sounds and so on. Very, very interesting. You know, and something which is only being rediscovered in the West, you know, the effects of sound and consciousness and so on, you know. Right. But these guys have mastered it hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Right, it's been part of them. Now, do they often do it in pairs, or they sing singly or groups? Is there a...
Singing in pairs is very unusual.
Oh, okay.
You know, and it would be a dissonance normally, because the chants aren't just songs; they're a vibration, a frequency. You know, they're sung for particular reasons. There's certain alter or set up a certain consciousness. And if anybody else sings during that, it can shut down your trance, shut down your visionary state. It's a vibration. People have to know this, and that's why it's so unusual that two shamans. In this case, Benjamin and Rolando. Benjamin's the old guy, and Rolando is the young guy. Can sing in such kind of harmony, which enhances the experience and so on. So that's why it's so unusual.
Okay, that's good to know. Yeah, because I'm just sitting here listening to it. It affected me. I really got drawn into it.
Yeah,
into
their. And when it was playing, I was getting lost in it a little bit as well. That's why I thought to shut this down, because, you know, let's close off a little bit and come back to later on, because I can go off in my little space with this, hearing that as well, you know.
Indeed. Yeah. No, beautiful. Fantastic. I'm so glad you brought that. And
my pleasure.
And, now, you talked about art, obviously, and ayahuasca art, and you've just completed, it's coming out next year, a very major book on Pablo Amaringo, who is an incredible ayahuasca artist. He passed away
in November.
So this is tell us something about I can read.
Why don't you read the catalogue entry from the book is could be called The Ayahuasca Visions of Pablo Amaringo. It's published by, and it will be published next year. It comes out in the spring catalogue in 2011. And to be published by the American publishers and so on. But look, you can read out the thing you want to, the catalogue entry and so on.
Yeah, the Ayahuasca Visions of Pablo Amaringo by Howard G. Charing and Peter Cloudsley. And recognized as one of the world's great visionary artists, Pablo Amaringo was renowned for his intricate, colorful paintings inspired by his shamanic visions. A master communicator of the ayahuasca experience, where snakes, jaguars, subterranean beings, celestial palaces, aliens, and their spacecraft all converge, his arts present an indigenous doorway to the transcendent worlds of ayahuasca, intended for contemplation, meditation, and inspiration. Illustrating the evolution of his intricate and colorful art, this book contains 47 full-color reproductions of Amaringo's latest works, with detailed exploration of the rich Amazonian mythology underlying each painting. Through their long-standing relationship with Amaringo, the authors are able to share the personal stories behind his visions and his experiences with Amazonian people and folklore, capturing Amerigo's powerful ecological and spiritual message through his art and words. And he has contributions by Graham Hancock, Jeremy Narby, Robert Venosa, Dennis McKenna, Stephen Breyer, and Jan Coonan. This book brings the ayahuasca experience to life as we travel on Amerigo's visionary brush and palette.
That's nice, that visionary brush and palette.
And obviously can't see what the examples of the paintings that Pablo does, but do you have a website with some of his paintings? No, I don't.
There will be when the book comes out. There will be a website with vignettes and so on, summaries of the paintings and so on and so forth. But these paintings have never been published before. That's the important thing here is and. And it's not just the paintings. The paintings are actually magnificent and fabulous, you know, in their own right. But they're just part of the story. You know, Pablo's wisdom, Pablo's spiritual teachings, you know, are in these paintings. They're in code. They're allegorical. It's many meanings and many levels. And it also contains what is interesting as well for me personally was that we're also documenting oral traditions, which would have been lost. You know, Pablo was a storehouse of this wisdom and knowledge about, you know, indigenous ways, plant medicines, their practices and so on, ayahuasca, the shamanism, and the whole kind of, not only that, I mean, but when you look at, read some of the material, he's talking kind of quantum mechanics and so on, you know. Mm. We were discussing that, the exposon thing, you know, and the Hadron Collider in Switzerland, and these particles, and Pablo's work is full of these kind of, this pre-matter formation, the formation of matter, how the universe came into being, that the celestial powers, you know, in the universe and so on. And
he already understands that, basically, intrinsically.
He understands that, and he talks about that, you know, and some of his really important stories about the Amazonian mythology, you know, and although he talks about these beings, these supernatural creatures, so to speak, you know, he talks about them in semi-mythological terms, you know, they exist. And they exist, but they're also allegorical. When he talks about the Sachamama, the Waramama, and the Yakumama, these are the great serpents of the sky, the earth and the sea and so on, and the water and rivers. It's also really describing the natural flow of the rainforest, the rainfall, the storms, the weather patterns which sustain and nourish life in the rainforest and so on. So he talks about these natural forces in personal terms with these semi-legendary, these semi-mythological creatures. But he says they exist. I've seen them. We know about them and so on. Very rich stories.
Incredible. And now perhaps just had a call from John, and he actually wanted to know how to spell ayahuasca. So I will spell it out because obviously it's...
It's in the book.
It's in the book. Yeah, buy the book and you'll know. It's A-Y-A-H-U-A-S-C-A. So it's A-Y-A-H-U-A-S-C-A. So you can Google it and find some more information about it.
I'll type in Pablo Amerigo.
Pablo Amerigo.
And his previous book came out, as I said, early 1992, I think, 1992 was published. And many of the themes in that book are expanded upon in this book as well. And some of the paintings he did in that book, he did the same theme again, but much more expanded, much more texture, much more content and so on. So it's a very, very interesting book. And as I said, it's a documentation of oral traditions and so on, as well as Pablo's wisdom. And the paintings have teachings in them. They have a guide to how to be a human being, a spiritual human being on the earth and so on, as well as all this information about traditional ways and so on. Yeah.
Well, can you maybe think of one of his pictures that you like, and could you describe what's on it and what he was trying to portray and the vision of it?
But some of the paintings were so complex and so detailed, so I realised I was, you know, working on each painting, that I could write a book about some of these paintings just by themselves, you know, a 40,000-word book. There's so much information in this. So, yes, I can do, but you've got the book there yourself. You can turn to any page. The manuscript's got the raw manuscript there. I brought it with me.
Right.
Away from England, you know, and with the colour plates in there. So, You know, so you got all things there, and you got the explanations there, and then they're from discussions and analysis of his work and so on, and we have had access to all his notes and journals over the years and so on, and also just so many meetings and discussions with Pablo about the meaning of the paintings, what's going on with it, and Pablo would never actually, wouldn't always tell you, oh, this is this. You know, he would talk about some maybe the outer characteristics, the outer qualities, and it was up to you to figure out what he was talking about. I had to figure out what he was saying. You know, I had to sit for hours with each painting. You know, thinking what was he saying here? What's Pablo mean here? You know, and
you had to do some work.
Intense. You know, I'd sit for hours with each painting. You know, with my big magnifying glass and you know, and some I'd put on the computer the high resolution image, kind of went in forensic mode. You know, detailed mode. You know, look at each motif and the positions of each motifs, and then suddenly after hours now, suddenly the radio receiver would click in and I'd hear Pablo's voice in my head saying, ah, explain it to me. And I thought, ah, I got it. Then I could start writing. I got it, you know. And when I went to visit Pablo, you know, and I said, look, you know, review meetings, this is what I've written about this, I've written about this. Have I got it? Yes. To intend the end, as you understand, you know. So it was very gratifying to get it. He wouldn't tell you exactly what the secret was, what the real mystery was. I had to get it myself. I had to really really sit for hours with it. And so it was intensive. It was frustrating. It was all those kind of things you go through. But it was so rewarding because I've got some richness in the content of some of his work. It's beautiful. Of course, we're radio, so we can't show you a single one of his paintings and so on. But the book comes out next year, so you know anybody who's interested, you can look Pablo, some of Pablo's works on the web, Pablo Amaringo, Ayahuasca Visions, which came out in 93, has some very interesting paintings, and this book comes out next year.
Yeah, just opened one picture, say, and just to describe it, and he does. There's a lot of people in his pictures, often, well, people and animals, and say this one, it's very blue, purple, pink. There's a lot of Amazonian faces. There's, you know, they're connected. Say one has a sort of an interesting tongue that goes into sort of collects into a group of people or huddled together. And there's some bird forms. There's weird palace and building forms. There's snakes. There's little insets of people in corners. I mean, it's just got the most incredible detail. There's something going on everywhere. There's planets I see, plants.
Every square millimetre of that painting has something in it, and these motifs are not just there for the sake of it. They have a significance. They have a meaning, and not just they have a meaning, but their juxtaposition, their relationship with the other motifs also has a story as well. So it's very, very complex material, and it's such a rich, I think the rich texture and detail is exquisite. I mean, you're seeing there, you know, A4 size reproduction of that for the book, for the colour plate. The book is going to be quite much larger. It's going to be 14 inches times 10 inches and hardback and so on. So, you know, very, very nice size.
Very impressive.
But that's smaller. Yeah. But when you think of these paintings, some of these paintings are 90 centimetres times 85 centimetres. We're talking, I know in the centimetre size.
That's about 3 foot, yeah.
Yeah, 3 foot times right, 2.5 foot. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're big, you know, and it's full of details, everything. And it all has significance. That's a nice painting looking at right now, that one there.
Yes, beautiful. It looks almost like a ship in the middle, isn't it?
It's a ship,
And there's people in the front, looks like maybe a shaman or somebody.
That's right, yeah.
With some group of people. And over here, it looks like a ornamental volcano almost, with flames coming up, with people in the flames.
They're not people, you see, and that's not just a normal ship. That's a Barco Fantasma. That's a Supe Luncha, you know, in the colloquial language. And, you know, and...
What meaning does that have, you know, for them?
Barco is... it's like fantasy boat or spiritual boat, and supe is it's a Quechua word and which means supernatural in some respects, supernatural boat, you know. And it's interesting because, you know, this in so many respects, this describes in the 19th century when the steamships first started appearing up the Amazon, The local tribes had never even comprehended or seen anything like that before.
Right.
It had a huge impact, these steamships. Suddenly there's noise and the steam and the lights and so on, you know, and it kind of got incorporated into the kind of the mythology, you know, these supernatural boats. They weren't supernatural, but for them they were supernatural.
It was, yeah.
But in this case, when Pablo does it, you know, they see that Supe Lancia transforms. It's a transformative ship. As you see the eyes there, it's like an animal in some respects.
On the front,
on the deck, you have all these great doctors and medicine people and so on. And they've all got names and everything. They're all identifiable people and so on. And the Supe Lancia transforms into the Yaku Mama. Yaku is Quechua for water. Mama means mother, mother of the waters and so on. So it's not really a boat. It's a boat which has been. It's a giant supernatural creature in the form of a boat.
Right.
And there's more metaphor and symbolism there. And the cauldron, the steam room, the boiler, and so on are also allegorical of how ayahuasca is brewed. Ayahuasca is brewed in steam and hot water and so on. So it's like the furnace is also describing ayahuasca as well. You know, the fire of ayahuasca
within it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're taking what is a motif of a boat, but I've just given you many, many levels of what it is. You know, it's right. And some of the paintings you actually see that the boat transforming other paintings into the Yaku Mama. Yaku Mama transforming into the Supe Lancia, or vice versa. It's the Supe Lancia and the Yaku Mama at the same time. You know, all these very many, many different things there.
Yeah, so fluid. That's
and you see in that, on the right hand side that pot, the Shibiba pot, with those intricate designs.
Right.
You see the pot there, the pot. That's it there. Well, those designs, you know. So and they're the muses playing musical instruments. You see the muses.
Oh,
the
muses? I see. Yeah, I see the strings.
Yeah, the musical, the muses. I mean, that's part of. As I said, the sound, the importance of sound. And Pablo always said that the universe was formed from sound. Sound is vibration. You know,
vibration,
and so on. You know. And all these things have many, many levels of meaning. And one of the, you know, when you know, I knew Pablo died last November, and I knew last year, but you know, early last year, because he had dengue twice in 2008, and it was a very severe illness, you know, and at that age, you know, it's not very good. But and he never fully recovered from the dengue, and. And he grew weaker, a lot weaker. He wasn't lost his physical vitality in many respects. And over last year, 2009, every time I saw him, he was kind of fading away. And you know, and I knew, and I called. He may not make it. He may not be here for the publication of the book. And he knew as well. He knew as well. He says, you know, some of the things he said to me, and they're in the book as well. Things he said about that. And
was he still painting even last year?
He was painting. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was painting and did some exquisite work. Because when he paints, he just doesn't sit and paint. He sings. He chants. See, the chant you heard before, he chants. You know, he sings some of his chants. He always chanted when he painted. He was a shaman as well.
Okay.
Ayahuasca. He was a shaman. And a very senior shaman as well. And so he chants. So each painting isn't just a painting. It's imbued with this sound, this quality and so on. And so he's always said, you know, you look at the painting, you focus, you concentrate on meditating on this thing, you pick up the sound, you get the vibration, you get the medicine of the painting. So I can't, you know, it's difficult to say, you know, just without showing anybody the intricate detail of his work and the many levels. You know, which you just, you know, just giving you an idea of, conveying some kind of idea. It's the sound, he chants. It's the formation of the motifs, the juxtaposition of the motifs. And there's many things that mean, see the snakes there.
Right, in the water around the boat.
Exactly,
yeah.
You know, and all the legendary mythological beings and so on. And if you read the narrative with it, the story of the painting, it's a lot's in there. I mean, it's exquisite. You know, I say so myself, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're listening to Howard Charing and... He's just finished up a book pre-publication about Pablo Amaringo, an incredible ayahuasca artist from Peru.
It's more than an ayahuasca artist.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
vision.
You know, he was inspired by ayahuasca. But the guy is never received any formal training. His work is really highly respected and highly regarded and so on. But he's not an ayahuasca artist. I would say he's a visionary artist.
Okay. Now
he's painting his visions, and he remembered every single one of his visions. And in the book, he talks about the techniques, how he remembers these visions. I mean, how you remember a vision when you're a different state of consciousness is not easy. But he remembers every single one in great detail. It's very interesting. Hmm. Very interesting that, yeah. But it is mind-blowing. I mean, all the oil and coal we produce, it all comes from plants. We talk about right. plants and so on. It all comes from one period in Earth's geological history, the Carboniferous period, you know. And I mean, it's just mind-blowing just to think how the world was covered with plants in that
yeah,
time.
Yeah,
you know?
So I mean, much.
The age of the plants, you know.
Yeah.
And that's animals came along and, you know. And, you know.
Started eating the plants, yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I see, this is an interesting thing. This is Terence McKenna, one of his quips, Terence McKenna. One of his quips was that animals were invented by plants to spread their seeds around. Which, you know, is an interesting, this symbiotic relationship between insects and animals and plants, you know.
Good point.
And there's a bee crisis on right now. I don't know if it's in the USA.
Oh, yes, it is.
Entire colonies disappearing. They're thinking, I read the paper in England the other day, thinking that it's a cocktail of the chemicals and fertilizers and pesticides, which are destroying the neurons in the brains of the neural nodes in the beans, so they can't perform their dances and their kind of communication and so on. So it's breaking down the ability of the hives to communicate with each other, and so on. So that's a serious thing. Without plants, we are screwed.
Oh yeah,
you know, yeah. And this book is about plants too, about how plant knowledge, you know, how important it is, and how the plants can communicate with us, how much medicine, and not just nutrition, right. but how much medicine plants offer us. We don't need these pharmaceuticals and so on.
Right.
So much medicine contained in plants and so on.
Well,
and that's a really important thing as well. And a lot of that information is in this book as well, Pablo's stories about medicinal plants.
We're going to talk about plants.
Plants, yeah.
And their influence on us. And, I mean, they were here before... animals were here, weren't they? I mean, they were here. They were doing their thing.
The plants have been around a long, long time. You know?
Yeah.
You know, long, long time. But what's interesting is so many things are interesting. You know, as I was saying before, all the oil and coal we have comes from plant material, you know, from
right.
one geological period, you know, the Carboniferous period. So you can imagine how the world was covered in plants at the time. It is... When you think about these things, and also I find interesting the symbiotic relationships between certain insects and plants.
Huh.
You know, how certain ants are engaged by to be nourished by the sap of a certain tree, and those ants defend against all other parasites and mites and so on. So the tree kind of employs, you know, kind of insect soldiers to protect it, and so many other things as well. And how many plants evolved to that's only certain insects and certain birds can reach the pollen and pollinate other plants and so on. So it's a huge amount of specialization. The thing that interests me, every time I go into plants, it's just astonishing. And although it's difficult to access if you come from a Western perspective, all the Latin names and all the classifications and species types and so on.
They put things in front of them almost.
It's too academic. And I know we have to have a consistent system where we label plants and so on, which I understand. But one of the challenges of the book is that many of the plants are called different things by different tribal groups. So one plant can have four or five or more names and so on. So that has to be... That's why we put the Latin names, you know, done the research of all the plants in the book, so the reader can have a consistent... can look at the plant, research the plant and so on. We gave the local colloquial name. No one would understand it. It's just a kind of a local name. But it's the medicinal properties, you know, and Pablo was always saying, yeah, that the plants provide us with everything, you know. I mean, and you think about this, you know, I mean, move away from the kind of the modern industrial kind of thing. All our food comes from plants. Everything comes from plants. Animals. But the animals, whichever animal eats, somewhere along the line, the first animal eats plants. You know?
Right.
And we eat plants directly and so on. And we share DNA with plants. We're not totally... removed from these things, you know.
Right.
And plants provide us nutrition. We know that. Plants provide us with shelter. I mean, wooden houses and thatched roofs and leaf roofs and so on and so forth. And also with medicines. And this is the most interesting thing. It's the most exciting discoveries being made when using these plants. And the local people, indigenous cultures, have been using these for many, many, many years. And many of the Western pharmaceutical operations are kind of patenting this kind of thing, which causes all sorts of issues, and local issues about ownership and cultural or scientific colonialism of these things. But... you know, see, the shamans in the Amazon, you know, I'll speak about those, they're not herbalists. They don't work, oh, one tincture of this, a potion of this with this, what this leaf with this leaf. That doesn't work that way. No, mm. One plant can be used to heal this or to heal that. It's the relationship that the actual shaman, you know, who has the, with the plant, that the plant will actually do the healing. So it's not... It's not kind of pharmaceutical. It's not even herbalism. It's to do with the personal relationship that the shaman has, his training, his diet with the plant. The plant has shown him things, revealed things to him that he will use. So it's a very, very different way than we in the West would understand the term medicine. You know, it's a more subjective experience, you know, subjective with the shaman. See, the shaman is conscious in his relationship, in his discipline. See, you know, it's not easy to be a healing shaman, to be a curandero. It's very challenging. You have to... discipline. You have to diet the plant for many, many months and learn its songs, learn its chants. The plant teaches you the song, and the song enables the shaman, as I said before, to alter in some respects, alter reality with the consciousness and so on, and to invoke the healing powers of that plant. And it's not just, oh, singing the song of this particular plant, he's singing the song of the archetype of that particular plant, okay. No, the spirit of that particular plant, which is, it's just outside the physical format of a flower. It's talking about the archetype of that. No, the greater right. form of this, the greater mind of this, and so on. And it's only human arrogance which denies the plant kingdom. I love the word plant kingdom. The plant kingdom, you know, a consciousness. Plants have been around for a long, long time. And although Western science and rational thought, you know, dismisses this, you know, there is a communication possible between plant minds and human minds. Except to do this, we need to become less animal-like, and this is the discipline, the training of these guys. You know, that they minimize or quiesce the human, animal, monkey-like, primate things we do, to become kind of more plant-like, and then the communication is possible, and so on. And the plant can reveal its power and its secrets, and so on. And the songs that the shaman needs to sing, the chant, the vibration he needs to bring to effect change, and so on and so forth. Very, very interesting.
To sort of channel that plant into.
It's very interesting. A previous book, a co-author called Plant Spirit Shamanism. You know, I explore more of that. You know, about how the shamans, you know, kind of work with the consciousness of plants. That's Plant Spirit Shamanism, published by Destiny Books. Available in the USA, obviously, because it's published in the USA. So it's obviously a nice cover and all that. Nice paper and nice words. And it's
okay.
Lovely. It's an interesting book, yeah.
And now, would each shaman really have a different experience with each particular one or group of plants? How does that work?
Is it that question? You've no idea how lowly that question is.
Okay.
I better start off with this thing, because, I mean, the word shaman is only a convenience.
Okay.
I'm using the word shaman purely as a convenient term.
For people to understand what you're trying to get at. Yeah.
I mean, shaman, you see, the problem is, the word shaman is from Asia, from Siberia. It's from the Tungus people, the Saman, which means in their language someone who knows, someone who sees, and someone who's aware, and so on. And it's been exported to the Amazon, you know. And only recently, in the past 20, 30 years, you know, and they don't know. I mean, they never called themselves shamans beforehand, or shaman, as it's spelled in Spanish. They're called vegetalistas, and the people who work with the plants. And there's so many subcategories and subspecializations. I mean, you know, there are shamans. I'll use the word again. Shamans, who were actually perfumeros. They were the aromas and the smells of plants.
Huh.
They're very, very powerful things. They're based in the work that plants attract. So, you know, flowers have been attracting for millions of years,
right.
Attracting insects, attracting birds, pollination, the scent, the aroma, and so on. And they work with that kind of quality, you know, the power to attract. So, for example, I mean, I've got a chant by a perfumero guy, Artiduro. And I'll play one of his chants in a minute if you want me to.
Yes.
I can. Okay, thank you very much. And he's a perfumero, and people, you know, ask him, I've got a new shop and a restaurant or something or other along those lines. I like to attract some customers. And he will, you know, go there and he would do his thing, and he'll make a specific, it's not industrial, this, it's a specific perfume smell to draw in customers and he was singing, he would chant into it, so it would be imbued with his that vibration, and that brings in customers, and you know, to attract customers, and also a woman can come to Arthur Dura and say, my husband's left me, he's found a younger woman and doing this, that, and the other, we want him back, the family wants him back, and he would do kind of a special aroma to draw him back, you know. So they use that these qualities, these intrinsic qualities of flowers and plants in many, many ways. A perfumero, there's a chontiro. A chontiro is a practitioner who works in bamboo. I mean, we're talking
bamboo.
We're talking real specialities here. I mean, really, and they would use it in form of darts. Like darts from like the arrows from the bamboo, and they were singing and chanting and so on. They could, of course, it can be used for good and bad. I mean, there's a very ambiguous situation here. You know, oh, this person is a bad person. They go to shaman. Oh, he's stolen my animals. He's chopping down my plants and so on. Can you stop him? You know, a lot of stuff goes on like that. It's not all pure and spiritual. It's really harsh realities out there where people are trying to harm other people, and some shamans are trying to cure the people who've been harmed by them. But then they get involved with the guys who caused the original harm. You know, it's a very messy situation. I mean, anybody who really is interested in that kind of thing, I can recommend a fabulous book by a good friend of mine, Steve Beyer. It's come out last year. It's called Singing to the Plants. And Steve has explored some of these really interesting, the harsh realities of that kind of world and so on. So they're not all wonderful medicine people want to heal people. Some, you know, are unable to do the discipline to be a healer, a curandero, and they succumb to the kind of the illusion of power and whatever issues they have with them aren't resolved, and they can cause harm. So a lot of this is going on as well, you know. And so Trintero, you know, will send, you know, for his chance and so on, a magical dart which can heal or can harm, you know. There's tobacqueros. There's shamans who specialise in tobacco. Not tobacco you get in Western cigarettes. The Amazonian tobacco is a different kind of Nicotina rustica. So it's much stronger form. It's mildly hallucinogenic as well. And it's native to the Amazon, and it's one of the most powerful plants. And they'll do all sorts of kind of healing and work with the tobacco plant. You know, but as I said, it's not the actual physical plant. It's the power behind the plant. Right. It's the spirit of the plant.
The vibration, whatever you call it.
Tobacquero. There's a Peliro, and a Peliro is another specialist. I mean, many specialists who works with the barks of certain hardwoods.
Oh.
And these guys are the real hard guys. You know, I mean, to be a Peliro, to work with the tree bark, the trees. I mean, it's another level of discipline. Some of our West Giros, all these specialists do. They're not hard boundaries. They do cross over. People can be a Peliro and an Ayahuasquero and so on.
Okay.
And some of these plants and these trees are very, very demanding, very challenging to diet and so on. So
to diet,
la dieta is when the practitioner, you know, or the person the aspiring seeker of knowledge, or the apprentice shaman, we wouldn't call this, you know, I mean, it's just words here. That they go off into the wilderness with their plant, and they consume that plant in either liquid form, make a drink of it, brew of it, or they'll physically eat it. You know, following a very, very strict regime of abstaining from human contact, abstaining from sex, abstaining from sexual thoughts, libidinous thoughts, and so on, avoiding salt and all sorts of other things, and sugars and all sorts of stimulants. They'll really try and kind of quiesce that animal aspect, and they'll come closer to that particular plant that they're trying to kind of learn from. And then during that process, could be, I think, 3 months to a year, for each particular plant, the plant will show them, open the door, and show the seeker or the apprentice or the shaman, I mean, we would call this, how to summon the power, how to use that power to heal, to help people, and so on. As I said, but there's so many specialities. See, the word shaman doesn't do it justice. There's recent import into the Amazon. There's so many specialities and subspecialities. Some of them are covered a lot of them are covered in the book as well, in fact, because there's a detailed glossary, you know, about all these things as well. And they're covered in the book, and there's different grades of shaman. You know, see, I'm using the word shaman here, but I shouldn't have been using the word. Different grades, different levels and so on, you know, of expertise. And, you know, there's bunkos and Bunko Pumas and Sumirunas and Bunko Sumis, and there's a whole range of different kind of designations, you know, for different levels, and as well as many different specialities. So a lot of information about that in this book, and also there's a really, really good discussion, observations in the book called Singing to the Plants by Steve Bai. He also has a great blog, by the way, in the web, you know, the www.singingtotheplants.com, singing to the plant, one word, .com. I recommend that, and as a really good resource. And Steve has written a nice foreword for this book as well, which I'm very pleased with as well. You know, so that's good too.
This connection with plants, you know, to learn about plants and to become, to get that.
What the shaman, you know, to use that word, how he relates to animals. Yeah, they're important too. Animals are kind of can be allies to the shaman. They can warn the shaman of impending danger. Certain birds and so on, certain animals, they get the protective spirits and so on. Yeah, and they'll learn the chants. I mean, as I said initially before, that story I told you, the shaman sang and all the insects, all the fireflies came along and so on. He was singing, he learnt the chant of those insects. The insects are the physical form of a spiritual force, a kind of a energy, an archetype. I mean, I'm using words that describe ineffable kind of things here.
Right.
But he knows he learnt those chants of those particular insects and animals to protect the ceremony and so on. Yeah, they'll learn the chants. They won't diet an animal, for example, but they'll certainly have a contact with the animal and so on, and to summon the spirit of the animal, where it will teach them. It's not, they won't diet an animal per se.
So it almost a symbiotic relationship, to use them to add more power or to just. Yeah, how would you explain that?
I won't say symbiotic, you know, because I don't know why the animal powers bother with humans or the plant. I mean, that's the question. I can't see that, you know, unless there is some beneficial, benign expression in some way or harmful expression, if it's sorcery and so on. So I can't really give you their side of the story. I can't say that. I can hypothesize and so on. But I can't really give you that side of the story. But what we're saying here, there are natural forces. There are forces around, you know, in existence, you know, which many people in the West are totally unaware of because it's not in our culture, it's not in our understanding of these things.
Right.
But some people are in, you know, indigenous peoples, through their traditions and culture, are still in tune with these primal forces of nature, and they can draw upon them, and they can do things with these things, and they're not in there for personal transformation, like the Westerners are, and for change and healing and so on, you know, of our psyches and so on, you know, this is a very, very different kind of experience. But yeah, they are in touch, they're in contact with, because in their reality that exists.
Right.
It's not a fantasy, you know. Not a fantasy like, oh, it's silly, how can people talk with animals? You know, but if you go and look back in all the legends and all the fairy tales we have, you know, in the West, there's always some kind of contact between humans and animals. I mean, you know, animals talk, animals speak, you know.
Right.
I mean, but that's a whole different study, a whole different story. There's a lot of research done on that kind of thing, you know. You go far back in everybody's lineage, everybody's life, everybody's kind of, not life, but everybody's, you know, kind of ancestry. And you'll find that we all come from some kind of indigenous culture at some level, at some stage, you know. And yes, and through fairy tales and through folklore, through mythology, we still have a kind of a thread of it. But it's dismissed as fantasy rather than something which actually exists. Now, in the Amazon, that is not a thread of fantasy. It actually exists. It actually has power. And that's the big difference. It's not a fantasy. It is real. And yes, I will attest to that. But this is real. I mean, I've seen things happen. And my own eyes, and I think, that's real.
Yeah, you were saying that you've seen things that literally, I mean, they just, in the normal world, just wouldn't happen. They just can't be real, but you saw them with your own eyes.
Yeah, I've seen so many things, you know, some things which, I've witnessed, and if I say, talk about it, it's a trick, they fooled you, and, you know, you're an idiot, there's some old conjury trick we can do it. So I've actually lost interest in even talking about it, really, because, you know, if you're interested, you're not interested. So I've no agenda here at all, you know. So I talk to my friends about things, you know, people who know I'm kind of a reasonable guy. I'm not kind of, you know, I'm a reasonably trustworthy kind of person, you know, and talk about my experiences. But certainly some of the things I'm not really going to even go to that publicly, because they'll just be, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point. I have no interest in that.
Right. No, I understand that. Yeah, because it. Well, that's it. There is. I'm sure just a lot of, per se, abuse now. You know, the West really, you know, getting involved, but for the wrong reasons. You know, obviously, like pharmaceutical companies, that they're trying to isolate a certain alkaloid out of a certain plant that will do a certain thing, rather than looking at that whole energy form.
Yeah, well, they have to. That's how they work. I mean, they can't work. They work in that kind of binary principle. You know, rather than seeing. You know, and we spoke about this afternoon, didn't we? About DNA.
Oh yes,
we spoke about DNA. You know, and it's the 97% thing. You know, so we science. I mean, I'm a big fan of scientific research and so on. The result, I think it's a fascinating thing. You know, it's fabulous. You know, we have identified, decoded 3% of the human genome, 3%, and the remaining 97%, we can't see what it is. So it's been labeled junk DNA, rubbish DNA,
left over. You
know? Not saying is we don't know what it is yet, DNA thing, it's just rubbish. Only last week I was reading in a magazine thing called a New Scientist magazine. It's kind of a scientific articles and so on and research going on. And it was about they say, hold on, you know, there is something going on with this 97% of DNA. You know, we can't actually realise and see what it is, but it has an effect on the 3%.
Hmm.
And then we were talking about dark matter.
Right.
You know, and we can see 3% of the particle makeup or whatever, atomic nuclear, whatever it is, scientific makeup of space and so on, but there are effects on the space that we can observe from things we can't observe, and that's dark matter, and there's a lot of interesting research and studies into this invisible force, dark matter. And we're talking about the Hadron Collider in Switzerland and so on, which is exploring some of these particles and so on. You know, so. And that they're saying, well, we know it's there because of the effect it has. We can't see it, we can't detect it, but we know something is there because of the effect. And now they're saying the same thing about this junk DNA. We don't think it does anything at all, but it's doing something that has an effect on the other, you know?
Yeah, it didn't just come into being for no reason.
As soon as we start judging things, this is good, this is bad, then we lose it. You know, it's important to get open minded. Everything. So all these things which we dismiss in the West, we need to get open. So if the pharmaceutical companies, for example, they can't operate on that personal, individual, subjective basis. They can't. They're not designed for that. They're designed to work on chemical compounds and molecular structures and so on. Things they can understand. Things they can prove that have effect and so on.
Right.
But so that isolates one alkaloid from something, for example, one particular plant. But what they don't do is to understand, because they don't have. It's not in their. That form of operation to understand the effects of the other alkaloids. So you can extract one alkaloid, but the other component of that particular plant is influenced and affected by other things. Right. It's called kind of holistic approach. They haven't got a holistic approach. Yeah. So the holistic thing. See, the holistic thing, holistic view of things. I'm not sure if it's spelled with H or with W these days. It's holistic or holistic, you know, which means the whole organism is studied, because every part of every component influences the other component, rather than taking it in isolation and so on. And so that, I think, is where we in the West, scientifically, have a lot to learn from the indigenous. I mean, I spoke to you about the Maui, the monoamine antioxidant inhibitor, how the ayahuasca functions. You know, one plant cancels the body absorbing the tryptamines, which would normally be absorbed, and that was only discovered in the 1950s, that effect. Wow. And as a result of that, things like Prozac and Ciroxat, all these huge money-earning pharmaceuticals, all are based on that principle.
Oh.
You know, the principle was recently, in the past 50, 60 years, you know, that principle was understood. And a medication like Prozac have developed from that. But the indigenous peoples, you know, the Indians, the tribal peoples, have understood for thousands of years, you know. How they understood it, we can't explain. The only way I can hypothesize, get my head around this, is that the plants told them.
Right, exactly.
It's that the plants said, hey, you mix me with that, or mix these two plants, and this is going to happen. Or this person's ill, and this plant will work. How do they know out of the many thousands of different plants in the Amazon basin? It's the richest part of the world with plants. It's a world of plants. I mean, it's a world of rivers, and it's a world of plants.
Right.
And that is this very special place. And once the world was filled with forests, filled with plants, and now that's not the case anymore. So it's really important to preserve the rainforest, you know, in many, many ways. And you know about all the theories of what's going to happen when the rainforest does go, as it's going to go. I mean, it's been deforested, and once it's gone, it's gone. You know, that's how it is. And the cows graze there and this kind of stuff. And they're building a road, a trans-ocean road from the Atlantic in Brazil to the Pacific in Peru. And once the road is there, I mean, it's going to cause devastation everywhere, because there's road, there's going to be hotels and garages and service stations and houses and people, farms and all that stuff. So, you know, it's maybe economically viable, interesting. It's like lots of money transporting stuff by ship or by plane. Yeah. But, I mean, it's not a good move. We should be protecting that rainforest, all the rainforests. Yeah. They're an important source, not just of the world's climate and so on, you know, or of global warming and trees. Trees absorb so much junk and rubbish. We should be planting trees. I mean, we should be planting. We should never chop down trees. I mean, I'll try to remember someone's name. I forget that. Move on. We should be planting more trees, planting more forests.
Yep.
That's what we should be doing. We need to, that is like the lungs of the earth. So, they produce the air we breathe. I mean, not even food we eat. The air we breathe.
I mean,
we're pretty dependent on plants, and we should really kind of have a ministry of plants in every national government whose job is to plant forests and his or her job to plant trees and to create forests and so on to bring plants back everywhere. People have gardens, you see, concrete over car parks and put rubbish in there and so on. Everybody should have their own little place. Gardens are important. A garden is a real pleasure, you know, a sublime pleasure to relax and to sit in and so on. And we should be surrounding ourselves with plants everywhere we can. You know, we need to recognize that plants create life. The air we breathe, the food that we eat, whatever it is plants. So
exactly. We need to be as close to them as possible, other words.
Yeah.
Should we play some more of that chant?
We've only got
12 minutes left of the show. It's suddenly...
Oh, right. I'm going to play a track by Artie Duro. Time flies. Duro is Perfumero, and he's got some beautiful chants. He lived as a young man with the Ashaninka. The Ashaninka are really wild people. I mean, they walk around naked and so on, and they all Westerners wear clothes. They degenerate and so on. You know, these are real tough guys. I mean, they don't play around with an Ashaninka guy. You know?
Okay.
And the language, he learned the language and so on. So I'll sit and play some of his things. Okay, you ready?
We're ready. Say who that was and what that chant was about.
That was Artie Duro, and he's a great guy. He has a fabulous voice, and it's a real sweet man. And And as I said, he's lived with the Ashaninkas, and he's letting their chance. And they talked to him a chance. You know, obviously they accepted him because these guys, you don't mess with these guys. I mean, they'll kill you as soon as you're looking at you.
Wow.
And these chants are extraordinary, and they're beautiful, beautiful. I can't understand a word. I mean, I can pick up a word here or there, but I mean, it's a language I don't understand. But the effect is exquisite, and I really enjoy his chants, and I've got loads of them, you know, over the years. So recording them and so on. So that's Artiduro for you, and he's a perfect mirror as well. You know, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
with,
yeah.
With smells.
Yeah, I've got an interview with Artiduro on scribd.com as well. I've got interviewed quite a few of the ayahuasqueros and plant peoples and so on, on the web. So, thank you very much for listening to me, and thank you for Arnold for having me here. And it's been really nice, and time has flown by. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Howard.